Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, June 20th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Thanks for joining our conversation this week on news and the news media. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Lee and Charles are off this week, and sitting in are Linda Kraxberger, the new Associate Dean for Undergraduate Studies at the Missouri School of Journalism, and Amy Simons, a member of our Convergence Journalism faculty. On our agenda for today, NBC News trimmed a bit of its interview last fall with former Penn State football assistant Jerry Sandusky. What the network left on the cutting room floor may come back to bite the man accused of sexually assaulting young boys. We'll look at a few local winners from the Edward R. Murrow Awards and discuss what they tell us about the changing definition of TV news. What does it take to get a job or keep one at the newly downsized New Orleans Times-Picayune? Well, how about more experience working across platforms and with social media? A reporter in Colorado runs afoul of his paper's social media policy and winds up being suspended. And we'll consider whether the Microsoft Surface will be the tablet to finally give the iPad a run for its money. Jerry Sandusky's wife, Dorothy, took the witness stand in his sexual assault trial yesterday. She denied seeing or hearing him molest young boys, though accusers say the attacks often occurred in the Sandusky basement. But an interview Sandusky gave last November to NBC's Bob Costas drew at least as much attention this week as courtroom testimony. More specifically, it was this previously unaired question and answer that prosecutors may introduce as the trial goes forward.
So it's entirely possible that you could have helped young boy A in some way that was not objectionable while horribly taking advantage of young boy B, C, D, and E. Isn't that possible?
Well, you might think that. I don't know. In terms of my relationship with so many, many young people, I would guess that there are many young people who would come forward, many more young people who would come forward and say that my methods and what I had done for them made a very positive impact on their life. And I didn't go around seeking out every young person for sexual needs that I've helped. There are many that I hardly had any contact with who I have helped in many, many ways.
NBC Nightly News did air that soundbite Monday night, and Brian Williams intends to revisit the interview on his primetime magazine show Rock Center tomorrow night. But Linda, the big question a lot of people are asking is, why didn't they include that in the original interview when they aired it back in November?
I actually didn't listen to the full interview that they aired in November. Crafting a television story, even one that you know is going to take up a large percent of your broadcast, even if you give it a lot of time, it is really quite challenging to pull the most efficient quotes that tell the best story the most succinctly. And for every one good soundbite that we use, there are going to be five soundbites that we leave out. So I don't remember how long the original interview was, but I can completely believe that in transcribing that whole thing that one soundbite got overlooked because he said a lot of damning things through that whole interview.
Well, and that, Amy, that was the point a spokesperson for NBC made when asked about it. You know, there was a lot of good content in that interview. This was just one piece we couldn't put everything in. And they also pointed out that Costas only had like 15 minutes to prepare for that
interview. He had 15 minutes to prepare. And when you bear in mind 15 minutes to prepare, he asked some very pointed questions that have been at the center of this case through the entire process. So, hats off to Bob Costas for the work that he did as a journalist mm-hmm. through this whole process. One of the things that was interesting, and that NBC was very clear to point out through this whole discussion, even this week, is it was asked that they reauthenticate the transcripts of this interview, was that the full transcript was published on the websites from the very beginning. It wasn't as though through the editorial decision to not air this soundbite that NBC was sitting on the information. It was made public the whole time.
No, and in fact, since the transcript was out there from the very day that the interview aired, why are so many print reporters and other people not, you know, pointing to it now? Why didn't they quote it back then? They had the transcript.
Well, and I think that's just the way we do news today in this day and age. Oh, if it was picked up by a defense attorney, now it's newsworthy. Now I'll attack NBC for not airing the full interview if somebody else thought it was important enough. But I think it shows busy journalists with too little time to go through every I don't have time to read every single thing that people draw to my attention, and so they probably didn't read the whole thing.
You know, since this program is about media criticism, lots of times we find ourselves pointing out the flaws of television news. So this week we decided to change things up just a little bit. The Radio Television Digital News Association recently announced its annual Edward R. Murrow Awards. Amy, Linda, and I have each chosen one award winner. And what we're going to do is watch and listen to just a little bit of each of those stories, and then we're going to talk about their significance. We're going to start with Linda's choice. It's from KMOV-TV in St. Louis. It won the Video News Series Murrow for its examination of efforts to bring jobs to the St. Louis area. Much of the series focuses on reporter Craig Cheatham's attempt to pin down the head of the Regional Chamber and Growth Association about his salary, budget, and administrative decisions.
Mr. Fleming, why don't you just talk to us?
Because
we've been trying to get an interview with you for 2 months. Here you are hiding in a hallway.
No, I'm waiting for lunch.
We wanted to talk about real issues, but Mr. Fleming just wanted to make everything personal and insult me.
I am readily available to anyone in the media who wants to do a straight story. You don't do straight stories. Your antagonistic and belligerent questions,
which include
obvious.
What? Which include what?
From 3 months ago, I'm supposed to carry that around in my head.
You
know,
you just described me as hostile.
Yes, right.
But you can't tell me why.
Right.
So, Linda, tell us why you picked this story.
Well, I'm probably damning myself in this process a little bit by I chose that particular soundbite, that particular part of the clip to air. I don't think that particular part of the clip is the award-winning journalism that we want to call to people's attention. I think what it shows is sometimes in television news, to get people's attention, to get them to watch a story, we give them a little sexy content to entice them for the rest of the viewing. And so in this case, Selling St. Louis focuses on a quasi-governmental entity. It's not government per se. Governments pay money to this Chamber of Commerce Association. And what they found was this quasi-governmental organization, the director was making the most money. He has a $1.8 million salary. And I think in general, doing a series of stories and holding somebody accountable who should be accountable and saying why is the job that all reporting, I think it's just indicative of the kind of reporting we should do more often. And in this case, I think it called attention to an organization that was in some cases not helpful, and in other cases somewhat harmful to promoting economic development and employment in the St. Louis area.
I thought it was a well-done story myself, but I do wonder, Amy, Linda brings up a good point. Does this sort of ambush-style interview, whether it's, you know, the main part of the story or just the, you know, the icing on the cake or whatever, does it still work? Does it help us understand the story better, and does it really get the audience in the tent?
It's interesting watching through a bunch of the different examples from different markets, and we may see this a little bit later in another one of the stories we discuss. It is a pattern that we're still seeing over and over and over again. I think it's a pattern that works for the reporter, and I think the audience does kind of see it as that person that they're interviewing has something to hide. And it's a technique that we're using as reporters, and by we, I mean investigative reporters as a whole, that kind of signals to the audience there's something going on here. If they're not willing to talk, that's how you know there's something wrong there. And that's how they're drawing people into the tent.
Well, and I think that the issue of ambush journalism is, as a reporter, did you try every other conceivable way to get the story? And so in certain cases, we have to trust that they used legitimate, reputable means, and they did everything possible. And this was the last possible way they could do it. And it's one that's effective in demonstrating that someone is evasive. But you can ambush somebody when you haven't legitimately right. tried to get the story from them and you haven't tried legitimate means. And even a nun could look guilty if you, you know, came up to them and surprised them with a camera and said, I want to ask you about your involvement with such and such.
You also mentioned in bringing this story to our attention and choosing it that KMOV in St. Louis is not known for being the news leader in the market. Well, TV stations can react a lot of different ways to that. They can do a lot of mediocre stuff and stay second or third place, or they can be a bit more aggressive. Does this suggest anything to you with regard to this particular story?
I think in this particular story, it just shows that good journalism can be done by organizations that aren't the most popular. And typically, popularity is linked to things that that have to do more with looks than they have to do with depth of or quality of content.
And, you know, we're always looking for stories like this for impact. I mean, it's great to have a big story, but did anything come about as a result of it? And the person they focused on, this Mr. Fleming, who was the executive director, he did retire back in December. We don't know that it had anything directly to do with KMOV's reporting, but we do know that it happened after they ran the story. Well, next up is Amy's Choice, and it might at first blush seem a bit odd, the Radio Television Digital News Association giving an investigative reporting award for a series about Massachusetts judges and how they frequently acquit people accused of driving drunk. But this Murrow Award didn't go to a TV station, but to the Boston Globe newspaper. Here's an excerpt.
I don't know if sympathetic is the right word. I think they're not afraid to find somebody who they believe to be not guilty, not guilty.
We've always been behind the curve when it comes to taking steps against drunk driving.
Ron Bersani is the grandfather of Melanie Powell, the teenager who was killed in a driving accident and for whom the Melanie's Law is named.
What it ultimately boils down to is the policeman's word against the driver's word, because we don't allow the police to have some of the tools that are absolutely a part of prosecution in other states.
Besides the reluctance of many judges to ever convict someone for drunk driving, there are other factors that are pretty unique to Massachusetts that make it hard to convict someone. One of them is that there is a pretty big loophole in Melanie's Law, where, yes, there are sanctions, you lose your license for refusing the breathalyzer, but if you're found not guilty, you get it back, whereas in many states, it's a separate offense, whether you're convicted or acquitted. There's another thing, which is that you can't use someone's refusal to take a breathalyzer against them in court. And we're one of only two states in the country where it can't be used as evidence against someone.
Okay, so Amy, tell us first of all, why did you choose this story?
Okay, the reason I chose this story, not even so much about the story itself and the idea of the investigation, because in Massachusetts it's called, I believe, OWI, operating while
under the influence,
or something
yeah,
like that.
Right.
Yeah. Newspapers have been doing stories and investigations like this for as long as there have been newspapers. But to me, this story was just indicative and is the perfect example of the changing and the evolution in how journalism is being practiced these days. And this clip is something like 9.5 minutes long, and it's showing how journalists at the Boston Globe are now telling stories using video and animated graphics and doing on-camera interviews and doing ride-along with police and gathering data and images in ways that they've probably been doing since the Boston Globe published its first edition however many years ago, but it's also evolving and learning different ways to bring those elements to the audience in a way that's meaningful. It's also indicative, too, of, you know, the Murrows are handed out by RTDNA. RTDNA, not so many years ago, was the Radio Television News Directors Association. So the organization has completely rebranded itself to really demonstrate how important online journalism is to the future of journalism as well.
Say a little bit more about that too, Linda, because, I mean, you know, we have been members for a long time of these, what was traditionally broadcast news organization. They didn't just give one award to the Boston Globe. They gave them many awards,
six.
And they gave out a total of, I think, 21 non-broadcast awards this year. What does that say?
Well, I think it sends a message to traditional television stations that says, you don't own the airwaves anymore. You might still own the airwaves literally, but you don't own the means of producing video content. And good video content, wherever it is published, whether it's broadcast for an audience or whether it's published online, is still valid, is all valid content and useful. I also think it says something about the change in our print colleagues, that print, that newspapers are now beginning to embrace video, that it doesn't matter how people get your story, that the reporting is what's important. And if you're going to reach more people with video content than with text, then maybe video is the what you want to be producing.
Well, and in fact, Amy, you worked for a company, the Tribune Company, for many years, was an early innovator in this area with a television station, a newspaper, cable outlet, doing all this work together. And I guess I'm curious to know, in the example you brought to us from the Globe, was this sort of a different vision of doing video? Because we oftentimes hear newspapers talking about they have a style that's different from TV. Or did they employ successfully more TV-centric techniques in this piece?
Well, I think this piece specifically that we looked at did employ a lot of those television-centric mm-hmm. techniques, with some of those animated graphics, with some of the interviews. And the way that those interviews were shot and lit, they look very much like what you would see in a television network news magazine program. But one of the things that newspaper video does and incorporates so well is using the reporters who worked on this investigation as experts to explain the significance of the stories mm-hmm. and the reporting, and to bring some of that analysis into it and serve it as kind of the big picture explainer of what's really going on here and why it's important.
And by the way, we have links to the video from all these stories, as well as to the any of the print material that went along with them, on our blog, so check them out. We think they're definitely worth your time. Here's my pick. It's from the 2012 Murrow Awards as well. It's for video news series from smaller market TV stations. This one, WVUE, the Fox affiliate in New Orleans, they did a series of investigations into some really questionable spending practices by an elected official.
The expenditures include a $1,803 dinner at Morton's Steakhouse. 3 months later, he spent $995 at Morton's, and also $376 at the Rib Room, $484 at Ruth's Chris, $892 at 1179. The list of pricey restaurants goes on and on, plus flights, hotel rooms, all paid with little explanation, all paid with campaign money.
I mean, these are huge expenses, the same restaurants over and over and over, not $100 meals, not $150 meals. They're $800 or $900 meals.
The elected official in question is Jeff Hingle, the longtime sheriff in Plaquemines Parish.
And really, the excerpt we played for you was just the tip of the iceberg of this story. Reporter Lee Zurich used open records requests to acquire documents that showed the sheriff was also double billing both his office and his campaign for some pretty questionable deals with some friends and associates. And this sheriff, Hingle, he resigned this spring shortly before federal prosecutors charged him with mail fraud and bribery. Well, the reason I picked this story, a couple of things at least. As with Amy's choice, this station won multiple awards this year. We think that's a good thing. WVUE has been doing excellent investigative journalism for a long time. And frankly, we've been doing a lot of talk this past couple of weeks on the show about New Orleans because of the decision by the Times-Picayune to buy out nearly half its news staff and reduce its print schedule in favor of more online content. I guess I should point out, though, Linda, that WVUE's investigative work, especially all this months and months of going through documents, requesting mm-hmm. them, is really not the norm today for television no. news, or for that matter, for print newsrooms.
No, not for any newsroom. And the issues have been that as newsrooms have as they watch revenues decline, they've had to slash their staffs, and you have to look at what's the most cost effective method. And if you have somebody doing 3 months worth of work and it arrives and becomes, you know, 3 days worth of stories for your news outlet, is that an effective use of your resources? Yeah. Some places are beginning to come back around and say, yes, that is an effective use of our resources, because by doing that, we'll take Associated Press content and some more stock kinds of content to fill the paper on other days, because otherwise this is a story that wouldn't have been told. Other people have a different business model where they say, no, that's not going to be the most effective. The most effective use of my budget is to have a weather person who's doing local and regional weather.
Yeah, I guess, Amy, if I could be just a tiny bit critical of this or any of the stories we chose this week, it might be the way in which they use their website effectively or not to actually communicate and extend these stories. In some instances, it was hard to find the video. In some instances, mm-hmm. it was hard to find any text or links or documents that accompanied the video. How good a job are TV stations doing with their websites?
To be frank, not very good. And that's something that I have actually been doing some work with different local stations over the course of the last year and a half to kind of beef up some of that, because that's one of the things that television stations have not really learned how to use their website in that sort of a way yet, and kind of the same way that newspaper websites have. They don't think that to take all of those documents that they've gathered all the way through and make those public. They don't think to go ahead and take extended interviews and to add some of those extra elements and to create a richer user experience to really drive home the importance for their audiences.
And the other thing that we would add about that, several people that we've had who we have in our midst here at the University of Missouri who do extensive research on what's called user engagement. Once you have those materials, do you just present the story and the story's done? Or do you present the story and allow people to comment in such a way that they might have more information that adds to and continues to that? We do that informally behind the scenes with phone calls, but we're not as open to having that process be out there in public.
And that process is something we do need to continue, because that's how we make our reporting cyclical.
Well, and that's a good lead into the next thing I want to talk about. As I mentioned, I picked the New Orleans story because it ties into what's been going on at the Times-Picayune. As you may recall from what you've read or heard from us, they're about to reduce their publication to 3 days a week, put more of a focus on online content on their portal called NOLA.com. Well, those employees that are getting to stick around, about half of them, are getting new job descriptions this coming week, and they're already posting some job descriptions online advertising for new reporters. I thought we might just take a couple of minutes to look at one of the ads. This is for an all-topics reporter. I think it's pretty amazing how different this is from the typical job description or posting we would have seen just 5 years ago. So I'm going to read just a little bit of it and get your reaction. Job details. The reporter will report, produce news stories for various platforms, and act as a statewide expert and discussion leader on high-value topics, meeting audience demand for immediacy, depth, and engagement. They have to understand how to engage in story aggregation, post frequently and incrementally to the web all day, monitor reader comments, elevate those into story posts, interact on social media platforms, on and on and on. Quite a different job description, and I would guess this is going to be the norm.
I would agree with that. I think the definition of shoe leather reporting has changed, and what you have just read is the 2012 definition of shoe leather reporting. Our whole way of acting as a society has changed. We now engage with each other on Facebook. We don't sit in coffee shops the way we used to. We don't meet our friends for lunch the way we used to, or to go out to movies. We're now engaging with people online. And that's translating into how we practice journalism as well.
I do think there's a lot of angst, though, that some traditional journalists are expressing about this. Like, well, all of the focus is on the technology and none on sort of the traditional skills or standards or ethics of journalism. In fact, we had a group from the American Society of News Editors, who represent the management in newspaper newsrooms here this week, because we're doing a partnership with them. They're moving their headquarters here. And you heard an awful lot of comments about how we're having to hire these young journalists these days, Linda, that know all the tech, but they don't know the standards and the ethics. We might push back a little bit, and we might have a sort of a different perspective teaching those young journalists, but I think that's kind of a self-defeating attitude.
Well, I don't know so much about that being a self-defeating attitude, but I do know in this case, the fear is real. We don't know if the fear comes because the people who were laid off were belligerent about beginning to use the tools. I think there have been, there's been an attitude in many newsrooms that people thought, well, that's somebody else's job. That's not real reporting. Real reporting is what I do, and I do it in this particular way, and I'm never going to change my behaviors. Now, it's also possible that in the new media world that even people who were willing to participate in these practices weren't fast enough or adept enough, enough at using the tools. And I do think when we first started all of this social media, you know, it doesn't seem like that long ago that right. this was brand
because
new.
It wasn't that long ago.
It was brand new to all of us. And I said, there are going to be new jobs in the future where we identify the job as curating content and hosting conversations and then pointing out of those conversations, what is the most useful to you? And the problem with old school right. news, or I don't, they're not old fashioned, but old school news organizations is they only have so much money. So they can't keep adding new jobs without getting rid of some of the old.
Well, speaking of social media, you know, Amy, you brought to our attention a story involving a Colorado reporter who recently violated, according to the paper, their social media policy. His name is Barrett Tryon. He's on administrative leave right now while his employer investigates, and it's unclear whether he's being paid while he's on leave, but it's very clear that a lot of folks in the news business and outside of it think the Colorado Springs Gazette is going a bit too far. So here's a little bit of the background, then I'll get your reaction to it. The company's name is Freedom Communications. They own the Colorado paper and a bunch of other papers, too, and they announced recently they were selling out to another group owner. Well, the Los Angeles Times reported that the new bosses might spin off the little papers, including the Colorado paper, to finance purchasing a bigger one, the Orange County Register. The Colorado Reporter excerpted that bit of the story and posted it along with a link to the Times story on his personal Facebook wall. Shortly thereafter, his boss sends him an email saying he's violating the company's policy by, quote, creating social media communications that might be misconstrued in a way that could damage the company's goodwill and business reputation, even indirectly. What do we make of that?
The irony that it's Freedom Communications.
Well,
there's some irony there. But, you know, he excerpted, he did not offer any kind of commentary, and his defense in this whole thing was he was simply spreading information on a personal Facebook page. I understand that completely and entirely. At the same time, I kind of also see what the employer is saying, because we are all representative of the brands that we work for, and he may see it as his personal Facebook page, but other people who may be subscribing to him, other people who maybe seeing that page may not see that distinction. So it's something that I see both sides of. I don't know that anybody is 100% in the right on this one. And it will be interesting to see if it's even made public when the investigation's complete.
Well, and clearly there's more than one side to the story, but the National Labor Relations Board thinks that this policy and many others like it may be illegally restricting their employees and their free speech rights. So we'll keep an eye on that. We are not going to have time to talk about Microsoft's new tablet, the Surface, today. We'll have to take it up on a future program. But needless to say, there's a lot of speculation about whether finally somebody has come up with the, not the iPad killer. Nobody's going to kill a company that has 90% of the market right now. But we're going to keep an eye on that and see whether or not this new tool really will work. A lot of journalists, frankly, have been not quite as enthusiastic in their coverage of this story as some others. And so, you know, we'll watch it and see what happens. But that's all our time for today. Thanks to Linda and Amy for sharing their thoughts on this week's stories. Thanks to our technical team, Travis McMillan with RJI and Kyle Felling with KBIA. And thanks to you for listening and watching. There's more background on our blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. You can also leave comments, questions, or suggestions on the blog, or you can send them via email at views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. Lee Wilkins will host next Wednesday's edition of KBIA's Views of the News. Well, it's too bad I wanted to talk about that thing.